Drama. The play's the thing, says Hamlet, wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. Catch is indeed the word, for conscience moves swiftly or withdraws within itself. It has to be caught on the wing, at that barely perceptible moment when it glances fleetingly at itself. The everyday man does not enjoy tarrying. Everything, on the contrary, hurries him onward. But at the same time, nothing interests him more than himself, especially his potentialities. Whence his interest in the theater, in the show, where so many fates are offered him, where he can accept the poetry without feeling the sorrow? There at least can be recognized the thoughtless man, and he continues to hasten toward some hope or other. The absurd man begins where that one leaves off, where, ceasing to admire the play, the mind wants to enter in. Entering into all these lives, experiencing them in their diversity, amounts to acting them out. I'm not saying that actors in general obey that impulse, that they are absurd men, but that their fate is an absurd fate which might charm and attract a lucid heart. It is necessary to establish this in order to grasp without misunderstanding what will follow. The actor's realm is that of the fleeting. Of all kinds of fame, it is known, his is the most ephemeral. At least, this is said in conversation. But all kinds of fame are ephemeral. From the point of view of Sirius, Goethe's works in 10,000 years will be dust and his name forgotten. Perhaps a handful of archaeologists will look for evidence as to our era. That idea has always contained a lesson. Seriously meditated upon, it reduces our perturbations to the profound nobility that is found in indifference. Above all, it directs our concerns toward what is most certain, that is, toward the immediate. Of all kinds of fame, the least deceptive is the one that is lived. Hence the actor has chosen multiple fame, the fame that is hallowed and tested. From the fact that everything is to die some day, he draws the best conclusion. An actor succeeds, or does not succeed. A writer has some hope, even if he is not appreciated. He assumes that his work will bear witness to what he was. At best, the actor will leave us a photograph, nothing of what he was himself. His gestures and his silences, his gasping or his panting with love, will come down to us. For him, not to be known is not to act. Not acting is dying 100 times with all the creatures he would have brought to life or resuscitated. Why should we be surprised to find a fleeting fame built upon the most ephemeral of creations? The actor has 3 hours to be Iago, or Alceste, Phaedra, or Gloucester. In that short space of time, he makes them come to life and die on 50 square yards of boards. Never has the absurd been so well illustrated, or at such length. What more revelatory epitome can be imagined than those marvelous lives, those exceptional and total destinies unfolding for a few hours within a stage set? Off the stage, Sigismondo ceases to count. 2 hours later, he is seen dining out. Then it is perhaps that life is a dream. But after Sigismondo comes another. The hero suffering from uncertainty takes the place of the man roaring for his revenge. By thus sweeping over centuries and minds, by miming man as he can be and as he is, the actor has much in common with that other absurd individual, the traveler. Like him, he drains something and is constantly on the move. He is a traveler in time, and for the best, the hunted traveler, pursued by souls. If ever the ethics of quantity could find sustenance, it is indeed on that strange stage. To what degree the actor benefits from the characters is hard to say, but that is not the important thing. It is merely a matter of knowing how far he identifies himself with those irreplaceable lives. It often happens that he carries them with him, that they somewhat overflow the time and place in which they were born. They accompany the actor, who cannot very readily separate himself from what he has been. Occasionally, when reaching for his glass, he resumes Hamlet's gesture of raising his cup. No, the distance separating him from the creatures into whom he infuses life is not so great. He abundantly illustrates every month, or every day, that so suggestive truth that there is no frontier between what a man wants to be and what he is. Always concerned with better representing, he demonstrates to what a degree appearing creates being. For that is his art, to simulate absolutely, to project himself as deeply as possible into lives that are not his own. At the end of his effort, his vocation becomes clear: to apply himself wholeheartedly to being nothing or to being several. The narrower the limits allotted him for creating his character, the more necessary is talent. He will die in 3 hours under the mask he has assumed today. Within 3 hours, he must experience and express a whole exceptional life. That is called losing oneself to find oneself. In those 3 hours, he travels the whole course of the dead-end path that the man in the audience takes a lifetime to cover. A mime of the ephemeral, the actor trains and perfects himself only in appearances. The theatrical convention is that the heart expresses itself and communicates itself only through gestures and in the body, or through the voice, which is as much of the soul as of the body. The rule of that art insists that everything be magnified and translated into flesh. If it were essential on the stage to love as people really love, to employ that irreplaceable voice of the heart, to look as people contemplate in life, our speech would be in code. But here silences must make themselves heard. Love speaks up louder, and immobility itself becomes spectacular. The body is king. Not everyone can be theatrical, and this unjustly maligned word covers a whole aesthetic and a whole ethic. Half a man's life is spent in implying, in turning away, and in keeping silent. Here the actor is the intruder. He breaks the spell chaining that soul, and at last the passions can rush onto their stage. They speak in every gesture. They live only through shouts and cries. Thus, the actor creates his characters for display. He outlines or sculptures them and slips into their imaginary form, transfusing his blood into their phantoms. I am, of course, speaking of great drama, the kind that gives the actor an opportunity to fulfill his wholly physical fate. Take Shakespeare, for instance. In that impulsive drama, the physical passions lead the dance. They explain everything. Without them, all would collapse. Never would King Lear keep the appointment set by madness without the brutal gesture that exiles Cordelia and condemns Edgar. It is just that the unfolding of that tragedy should thenceforth be dominated by madness. Souls are given over to the demons and their saraband. No fewer than 4 madmen, one by trade, another by intention, and the last 2 through suffering. 4 disordered bodies, 4 unutterable aspects of a single condition. The very scale of the human body is inadequate. The mask and the buskin, the makeup that reduces and accentuates the face in its essential elements, the costume that exaggerates and simplifies, that universe sacrifices everything to appearance and is made solely for the eye. Through an absurd miracle, it is the body that also brings knowledge. I should never really understand Iago unless I played his part. It is not enough to hear him, for I grasp him only at the moment when I see him. Of the absurd character, the actor consequently has the monotony, that single oppressive silhouette, simultaneously strange and familiar, that he carries about from hero to hero. There, too, the great dramatic work contributes to this unity of tone. This is where the actor contradicts himself. The same, and yet so various. So many souls summed up in a single body. Yet it is the absurd contradiction itself, that individual who wants to achieve everything and live everything, that useless attempt, that ineffectual persistence. What always contradicts itself nevertheless joins in him. He is at that point where body and mind converge, where the mind, tired of its defeats, turns towards its most faithful ally. "And blessed are those," says Hamlet, "whose blood and judgment are so well commingled that they are not a pipe for fortune's finger to sound what stop she please." How could the church have failed to condemn such a practice on the part of the actor? She repudiated in that art the heretical multiplication of souls, the emotional debauch, the scandalous presumption of a mind that objects to living but one life and hurls itself into all forms of excess. She prescribed in them that preference for the present and that triumph of Proteus which are the negation of everything she teaches. Eternity is not a game. A mind foolish enough to prefer a comedy to eternity has lost its salvation. Between everywhere and forever, there is no compromise. Whence that much maligned profession can give rise to a tremendous spiritual conflict. What matters, said Nietzsche, is not eternal life, but eternal vivacity. All drama is, in fact, in this choice. Adrienne Lecouvreur, on her deathbed, was willing to confess and receive communion, but refused to abjure her profession. She thereby lost the benefit of the confession. Did this not amount, in effect, to choosing her absorbing passion in preference to God? And that woman in the death throes, refusing in tears to repudiate what she called her art, gave evidence of a greatness that she never achieved behind the footlights. This was her finest role, and the hardest one to play. Choosing between heaven and a ridiculous fidelity, preferring oneself to eternity or losing oneself in God, is the age-old tragedy in which each must play his part. The actors of the era knew they were excommunicated. Entering the profession amounted to choosing hell, and the Church discerned in them her worst enemies. A few men of letters protest, "What? Refuse the last rites to Molière?" But that was just, and especially in one who died on stage and finished under the actor's makeup a life entirely devoted to dispersion. In his case, genius is invoked, which excuses everything. But genius excuses nothing, just because it refuses to do so. The actor knew at that time what punishment was in store for him. But what significance could such vague threats have compared to the final punishment that life itself was reserving for him? This was the one that he felt in advance and accepted wholly. To the actor, as to the absurd man, a premature death is irreparable. Nothing can make up for the sum of faces and centuries he would otherwise have traversed. But in any case, one has to die. For the actor is doubtless everywhere, but time sweeps him along too, and makes its impression with him. It requires but a little imagination to feel what an actor's fate means. It is in time that he makes up and enumerates his characters. It is in time, likewise, that he learns to dominate them. The greater number of different lives he has lived, the more aloof he can be from them. The time comes when he must die to the stage and for the world. What he has lived faces him. He sees clearly. He feels the harrowing and irreplaceable quality of that adventure. He knows and can now die. There are homes for aged actors.